I'm happy to welcome to our program Najam Haider, who is assistant professor of religion at Barnard College and is a member of the Institute for Advanced Studies and author of the book Shia Islam, An Introduction and the Origins of the Shia. Najam, thank you so much for spending time with us tonight.
No, thanks for having me.
And of course, I was very interested to hear your perspective on the escalating conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran following the execution of a Shia cleric in Saudi Arabia on January 2nd. We had the burning of the Saudi Arabian embassy in Tehran and severing of diplomatic relations between the two countries. And it seems that the tensions, which have grown worse over the years, exponentially got a lot worse in recent days. And it's brought up a lot of what may be misinformation about centuries-long enmity between the Shia and Sunni branches of Islam. And I thought it would be important to understand this conflict better through your work and your research to tell us more about the origins of the current tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So maybe we could begin by just asking you, what is the accuracy or inaccuracy of the idea that Shia and Sunni have been in conflict for centuries, or at least many decades?
Well, I mean, there are two types of Muslims, Sunni and Shia, and there is a historical divide that goes back quite a few centuries, perhaps not all the way back to the death of the Prophet, as is often ascribed. But generally, there are two different communities, and these communities differ on some theological ideas, some doctrines, and they also differ on some historical aspects of what should or should not have happened at the Prophet's death in 632. And usually that's how the division is understood or explained to people. The Prophet died in 632. One group felt that one individual should have been the successor. Another group felt that another individual should have been the successor. And so we had these two communities that were at each other's throats from that point forward. But in reality, these communities developed centuries after the Prophet's death. And then they developed what we would think of as two very different theological orientations. And they got along for most of their history. They differed, but they tolerated each other and they lived together fairly peacefully. It might not have been a warm relationship, but these communities managed to coexist for a very long time. Now, the tensions that seem to develop between Sunnis and Shias over time usually happen at very specific instances. Times where there was instability, times where there was regional conflict, times where there's a general breakdown of order, or times when you had really two empires or two political powers that were competing, and one allied themselves with Shiism and the other allied itself with Sunnism, so that a regional rivalry was disguised as a sectarian conflict. And I think most of what we see happening today between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a political conflict that has acquired sectarian dimensions and sectarian language, but isn't necessarily an enduring, reified Sunni-Shi conflict that can be traced directly back to the time of the Prophet.
So, as you just said, it seems it's more of a political a struggle versus a theological struggle. But a lot of people, of course, adopt that language in talking about the dispute, generally speaking, at least. That's what we hear in the United States. What are the essential issues or disputes between Iran and Saudi Arabia, if it's not theological? What are their areas of dispute?
Well, I mean, you have to bear in mind that historically Iran is and that region that today is occupied by the modern state of Iran has been the dominant nation or the dominant political entity in the history of the Middle East. It's naturally in a central dominant position. And historically, the most powerful states have been in either southern Iraq and in parts of Iran. Saudi Arabia is a more modern state. It's a state that is only a couple of hundred years old, and its power is grounded in its oil. So what we have here is sort of an old entrenched political power, that being the state of Iran, in some ways being competed with or facing a rival for the first time in the Saudis. And so these two states, everywhere you look in the Middle East, from Yemen to Syria to Iraq, they are competing for political influence. They're competing for hegemony within the region itself. And so when you take something like the execution of Sheikh Nimr, the Shi'i cleric who was put to death by the Saudis, on one level we can think of this as the Saudis going after a Shi'i cleric. But on another level, and I think this is where it makes more sense, we can see that Sheikh Nimr represented a community within Saudi Arabia, the Shi'i community, that was demanding more economic rights, that was demanding a greater share of the oil revenue, and that was asking for more accountability in the government. And so he was seen as a threat. The fact that he was Shi'i is, it's not incidental, but it's not essential to his execution. He was a political threat, and that's why the Saudis executed him. Now, on the Iranian side, when we look at something like the burning down of the Saudi embassy, on one level we can say, well, this is just a direct attack on Saudi Arabia by the state of Iran. But within Iran, you have multiple internal divisions, and many people on the Iranian side, within Iran, feel that this was a direct challenge to the governmental establishment. By burning down the Saudi embassy, they were showing a defiance towards the Iranian governmental structure. So my point here is that we can think of this broadly because it's very easy for us. It's very simplistic. It gives us an easy, you know, way of trying to put all conflicts into an understandable matrix by saying it's Sunni and it's Shi'i. But within the states themselves and within each conflict individually, we can see that the underlying factors are much more political, and they have to do with internal, local factors more than they have to do with any historical division between these two groups.
We're speaking with Najam Haider. He's assistant professor of religion at Barnard College, and we're talking about Shia-Sunni conflict across the Middle East. Najam, why is it Americans should be concerned about this escalating conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia? On one level, there was hope that Iran and Saudi Arabia would work together to try and end the bloody civil war in Syria, and a more recent conflict that's broken out in Yemen, which pits Iranian-backed organizations and militias against the Saudi-backed government in Yemen. But from your perspective, what are the essential reasons we should be concerned and maybe try to prevent a wider conflict from erupting between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
I think we're already seeing a wider conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and that should concern us because that produces a general instability within the region. Iran and Saudi Arabia are fighting on multiple fronts, maybe not directly, but indirectly. As you mentioned in Yemen, as you mentioned in Syria, even in parts of Iraq. And I just don't see, you know, I don't see how we, I think any attempt to think that this is going to resolve itself by, you know, internally, as is, these two states will work together and find a way through. I think that's, you know, that's hopeful thinking, but I also think it's somewhat delusional. I mean, each of these places and each of these states, they have vested interests in opposition to each other. And until we can find some way of bridging that gap or exert pressure on both sides to negotiate something that would produce more civility, unless we are invested in that, I don't think we're going to see a peaceful resolution or stability in any of these regions. And I should add that the big problem here is our relationship with Saudi Arabia, because we have historically been unable and unwilling to apply any pressure to the Saudi regime to bring it to the table. I mean, just in the case of Yemen, I believe in November we approved a new arms deal for $1.2 billion to send more cluster bombs to the Saudis. And just a few weeks ago, just a week ago, I believe, the Saudis broke the ceasefire that had been in place in Yemen and began bombing mostly civilian and urban areas, including hospitals, which they've been directly targeting. So until we are able and or really willing, until we have the political will to ask the Saudis or demand that the Saudis come to the table, I don't think that this is being resolved anytime soon.
Professor Haider, there's been much criticism of Saudi Arabia and its proselytizing of the Wahhabi branch of Sunni Islam. And there are those who make a direct link between Saudi Arabia and organizations like Al-Qaeda, as well as ISIS, Al-Qaeda's newest form. What can you tell us about Wahhabi Islam as practiced in Saudi Arabia and financed? Its dissemination across the world is primarily financed by the royal family in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I mean, the Wahhabism comes from a revivalist, a general revivalist tendency that emerged in the Muslim world beginning in the 18th century. The Wahhabis called for a return to the original sources of Islam, which they felt should be literally interpreted. And so it was a religious revivalist movement that in the 1700s allied itself with the Saudi family. So the Saudis aren't religious clerics. They don't produce religious doctrine. They're allied with a community of scholars. And those scholars tend to have much more literalist views and be a lot less pragmatic than the Saudis themselves. So the first thing to bear in mind here is that the relationship between the Saudis and the Wahhabis is not direct. There's a degree of compromise that governs that relationship. The Saudis accept much of what the Wahhabi clerics say, and they allow the Wahhabi clerics a degree of influence within the state, but they put limits upon that influence as well. And so the Saudis, I think when we speak of Saudi policy, we also have to understand that within Saudi Arabia itself, you have multiple centers of power, and each of those centers of power has financial resources of its own. So there will be some Saudis and some Saudi princes that will support groups like Al-Qaeda, and there will be other Saudi princes that support other groups and other tendencies. There will be other Saudi princes that support more moderate interpretations. So it's hard to think of Saudi Arabia as having a direct, specific, coherent policy. And so the relationship what we end up having with the Saudis is that we support them to some degree. We give them financial aid. And on one level, the Saudis back us and back our interests. But at the same time, other elements within Saudi society may be working against the government itself of Saudi Arabia and against our interests. So it's very difficult to have a coherence within Saudi policy. And it's very difficult to think of the Saudis as having any one larger interest. So the relationship between the Wahhabis and the Saudis is much more complicated than what we generally think.
Although it's complex, as you explain, the relationship between the Saudi royal family and various elements within the country that may support terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, there have been some that say Saudi influence in the United States Saudi influence in the United States is so powerful that it prevents prevents the U.S. government, presidents of either party, from really reading the Riot Act to the Saudi leaders to say, look, you've got to stop people in your own country from providing financial support to these terrorist organizations. I'm wondering if how you assess that view that the Saudis have enormous influence in the United States and prevent that kind of crackdown.
I think the Saudis have a significant influence in U.S. policy, and part of the reason has been that they are one of the few countries that we have had a good working relationship with for many decades. I think in this respect, the deal that was signed, the nuclear deal that was signed with Iran, is seen by the Saudis as being an incredible threat. I mean, it's seen as being a real threat to their position within the Middle East, because it allows the possibility that the U.S. will have other partners to work with in the Middle East other than the Saudis. And so I think their recent activism, especially over the last year, has been in direct response to the potential that Iran has of building relationships with the United States that will that at the same time will allow the United States considerable more leverage in its dealings with the Saudis. So this is in some ways a flexing of muscle for the Saudis. And the new leadership of the Saudis, they've undergone a power transition over the last 6 months also.
What do you make of that transition? What kinds of new policies are we seeing or likely to see in the near future?
I think we're seeing a much more confrontational Saudi Arabia. I think we're seeing a kingdom that feels that it needs to be more activist in the projection of its power. Previously, it had been this, you know, Saudi foreign policy had largely been financial. They'd been supporting trends in different parts of the world. They had immense financial resources that they could muster in building influence. And I think we've seen the fruits of that in many parts of the world. But I think now they're taking a direct military role. They've begun supporting particular groups in Syria, and I think contributed to the escalation of that conflict. They directly engaged and began and escalated the conflict in Yemen as well. And I think these are all instances of where the Saudis saying that they're going to be more activist in confronting opposition. They're going to be more willing to confront who they see as their primary enemy in the region, which is Iran.
And I did want to ask you about both the Syrian civil war and the Yemen war. The escalating conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran does not bode well for ending these conflicts anytime soon. I'm wondering if you share that view, and what, if anything, the United States could do to really help both these nations come together, at least in finding some common ground to stop fueling these conflicts in both Yemen and Syria.
I mean, I go back to the point of if we're going to supply military weaponry and bombs to Saudi Arabia and put no conditions on that aid, then this is not going to be resolved anytime soon. We do have leverage with the Saudis, and we can use that leverage in order to bring them to the negotiating table. So let me just preface it by saying that we have leverage. There's a way to do this. But the way to do that isn't by selling billions of dollars of weaponry to one of the two sides in this conflict. And when it comes to Syria and Yemen, I mean, what we really have are local disputes. They were local disputes in the very beginning. In Syria, you had sort of a civil war that began, a revolution that began after the Arab Spring. And in Yemen, you had a popular movement in the north that began to mobilize itself and post-Arab Spring try to assert its political influence and ask for a greater share of the nation's limited resources. But with the regional rivalry between the Saudis and the Iranians, when they got involved in each of these conflicts, it was very much like throwing gasoline on a small fire. It blew both of these conflicts up and increased the scale tremendously and made it sort of a zero-sum game for each of those countries. With Syria, the Iranians, I mean, Syria has had a close relationship with Iran for many decades. It was a geopolitical alliance. Syria was the only nation in the region that supported the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, and they see Syria as their only reliable ally left within the region. So to lose Syria for them is not viable. It would be politically devastating. For the Saudis, they see this as an opportunity to undermine Iran. And in the Yemeni case, right on the border of Saudi Arabia, Iran sees an opportunity to undermine the Saudis by creating or promoting or fostering a state that wouldn't be pro-Saudi at all, right on the border of the state. And the Saudis see this as completely unacceptable. So you see how these two conflicts are working. I mean, both sides feel that they have everything to lose in this conflict. And unless we can make this not a zero-sum game, unless we can bring them to the table and have them realize that you know, these conflicts should be discussed on a local level and not as part of a global or a Middle Eastern chess game. Until we can bring that type of sanity to the conflicts are going to just remain as out of control as they are at the moment.
Professor Haider, I had one final question. It revolves around history, and it's about 5 minutes left, but we could certainly scratch the surface on this, I think, and that is there have been many people, especially since the rise of ISIS and their cross-border effort to establish some kind of new caliphate, connecting Sunni populations in both Syria and in Iraq. There have been people pointing to the post-World War I Sykes-Picot Agreement that brought the colonial powers together, France, Germany, I guess. Well, it was mostly the Allies, right? It was France and Britain primarily. And they carved up the Middle East and created new borders to their benefit. but at the same time created a lot of instability by dividing populations without regard to culture and religion. And you hear some noise recently by people saying, look, these borders inherently make that part of the world unstable, and maybe there should be some thought as to discarding those Sykes-Picot borders that were, in no way related to the real world or to the benefit of the people living in the real world in those countries.
Well, I mean, I think one can make that argument, but we should really bear in mind that agreement and that division happened a long time ago. And I think the critique that you've given is a useful and an accurate critique. I mean, it was an indiscriminate sort of carving up of large areas of land. But you should also bear in mind that over the last 50 years, 60 years, national identities have emerged. The people who are in those regions, people who grew up in those regions, are generations removed from that division. And there has been and remains a sense of Syrian nationhood, or a sense of Jordanian nationhood, or a sense of Iraqi nationhood. It has existed, and it's really hard to put the genie back in the bottle at this point without doing, more damage in the long run. I mean, it's true that the Kurds have demanded a nation of their own for many years and have done so for decades, going back to that agreement. But for large parts of the population in the Middle East, this is something that is done. It's not reversible. And I think, investing our energies towards reversing that might be a counterproductive. I think it's more important to try to come up with political calculations that give lots of different groups within nations that, to be perfectly honest, are nations now, a more stable and representative government. I think that's where energy needs to be directed, as opposed to a reframing, a recarving of the region.
Well, there are people who point out that, we had situations, and they may not be attributable to the borders themselves, but you had a situation where Saddam Hussein was in charge, a Sunni leader of a majority Shia country, that you have the Alawites in charge under Bashar al-Assad in Syria, the Alawites linked with the Shia and the majority Sunni population in the nation itself. Bahrain, you've got a similar situation where you have the Sunnis in power over a majority of Shia country. I guess that can't be chalked up entirely to the borders and connecting it with who's in charge. But what do you make of that? And I guess we only have a short time left, but you could give us your best shot here.
Well, what I would say is that Iraq, if we're looking at Iraq, which is, I guess, the most glaring example here, although the other examples you mentioned have value, and I hope we can talk about them at some other point. But in the Iraqi case, I would say that, bear in mind that, Iraq was a national secular nation. It was for many decades. The Ba'athist regime that Saddam was in charge of was a secular regime. There were Shias who participated in the government. There were Shia Ba'athists. There were Ba'athist leaders. There were Kurds who participated in the government. There were Sunnis. They identified themselves as Iraqi nationalists. They were Arabs, Arab nationalists. And there were Christians who participated in that government. It was only post-1992, post the Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, that the government took on a more Sunni character in the aftermath of a Shia uprising in 1992 in the South, which was promoted by the United States and then not supported. So sectarianism emerged within, and the idea of a Sunni and a Shia, that conflict within Iraq really emerged post-1992 at a time where the central government of Iraq was isolated and in crisis and had begun losing control. So yes, sectarian issues and sectarian identity matters in Iraq today, but a lot of that is a consequence of the last 15 to 20 years. And really the point I'm trying to make here is that sectarianism becomes relevant in these instances. And so we can look in many places like Iraq and say, well, look, they have a leader that is quote-unquote Sunni and a population that is Shi'i, but that didn't matter historically. The norm is that it doesn't matter as much as tribal identity does or national identity does. It's only in very specific circumstances that it becomes relevant. Now, Bahrain might be a different case, but I mean, and Bahrain is a different case, but that would require a significantly longer conversation.
Right. Well, I'm sorry to begin it. We have to cut it short, but it's been fascinating and edifying. I appreciate you making time to be on the program tonight, Professor Haider. And yes, let's stay in touch, and I'll look forward to continuing the conversation down the line.
Thank you.
All right. And is there any website you'd like to direct our listeners to that might provide some information on the things that we've just discussed tonight, articles that you have, or what you recommend?
I can look. I don't have anything off the top of my head.
Oh, that's quite all right. I thought I'd ask. All right. Well, thanks again, and we'll stay in touch.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Assistant Professor of Religion at Barnard College, Najam Haider, and his book is titled Shia Islam, An Introduction and the Origins of the Shia.